Welcome to the Painting Lines Podcast, your one-stop shop for all things tennis. Join Eric and Aiden in their discussion for updates on news and pop culture, and from hot takes to betting, they've got you covered.
Ready? Set.
Welcome back to Painting Lines. Last week, we discussed tennis this summer, and this week, we're happy to be joined again by former world number 63 and Grand Slam champion, Justin Gimelstob. Justin, welcome back, and we're glad to have you on again.
Yeah, good to be back. It was so fun. We're going for round two.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff to discuss since we had you on last time, because that was just after the French Open and in the build-up to Wimbledon. So just kind of to kick us off, what were your thoughts on Wimbledon overall and the final in particular?
Well, yeah, obviously on the men's side, the Alcaraz effort was special. You would have been surprised if both Alcaraz and Djokovic won one of the majors each, but you probably would have thought that Djokovic would win Wimbledon and Alcaraz would win the French Open. So to have it flipped was, I think, unexpected. But I think what was most impressive was how Alcaraz regrouped after getting down so big so early and looking overwhelmed, especially with the matchup. And to see him problem solve in real time like that was, I think, the most impressive thing. Obviously, his game, you know, physically, he's such a marvel, great variety, but his learning curve, how quickly he just picked things up and made adjustments and was stayed calm enough to be able to turn things around, change some things, and then go take that match. And then also the way he held on that break point in the fifth set, if you really look at it closely, I mean, physically, what he's able to do to extend that point and to put that defensive lob in such an awkward position for Djokovic, and then how strong he finished it out, serving it out, was incredibly impressive. So I think that was, you know, great for the sport. I think you saw Sinner get to the semifinals, which was another nice progression, which then kind of foreshadowed him winning last week in Canada. But I think there was a spectacular Wimbledon in that regard. And on the women's side, the run by Ons Jabeur was awesome. It would have been amazing to see her finish it off.
I know.
She seemed a little overwhelmed in the final by the moment. And I don't know whether it was physical or mental or both, but she definitely didn't play the way she had been playing. But it kind of sets up a little bit to like a Novotna situation, like back in the day, God rest her soul, and her tragic passing. But I mean, it was an amazing story when Novotna lost that brutal final to Steffi and then came back a bunch of years later and finally won. Hopefully that's what happens with Ons. I mean, who knows? But you know, the young lady that won, take nothing away from her. She did an amazing job, you know, being a lefty on the grass. We saw it with, you know, her compatriot Kvitova a bunch of times. You know, if you're a hard-hitting lefty, serve well, have that. She had a really good two-handed backhand. So Wimbledon champion. Did an amazing job, beat a lot of excellent players, and you can only beat who's put in front of you. So congratulations to her. But Wimbledon is just, it's such a special tournament that the event's always going to create amazing storylines because of how special the event is. So it's just a very, very special place and special tournament. So worthy champions.
Yeah, especially on the women's side. Yeah, she won as an unseeded player.
Yeah, but I think that's a little misleading because, I mean, if you look at it, she's been to the finals of the French. She'd been to the finals of the Olympics. And, you know, so it was really, she was really an unseeded player more from circumstantially based on injury. But I think it's an amazing story considering that she was there last year as a spectator qualifying. I read about watching her friend play and supporting her friend and so forth. You know, so it was a nice storyline. I just feel bad. Like everyone was probably seemed like they were rooting for Ons and understandable. But yeah, I think the unseeded part was made to be more significant because she obviously capable of very, very big results even before Wimbledon.
Yeah. Going back to the men's final too, like you said, making those adjustments in real time and handling the pressure for Alcaraz, being able to win that second set in such a tight set, that very easily could have been a turning point if Djokovic takes that second set and all of a sudden Alcaraz is down two. You have to kind of assume that Djokovic is going to take the championship, but Alcaraz being able to deal with that moment, pretty impressive. But now looking forward, Djokovic came so close to maybe a position to win a calendar slam again, but now he was denied. And now going into the US Open, he maybe has a little bit less momentum. What do you think about the Djokovic era in terms of slams? Do you think he's going to take another one? Do you think he's done? Do you think that was his last big chance for one?
Definitely not. Count him out at your own peril. I think he's going to be more motivated and more focused. I mean, people forget he wasn't able to play the US Open last year. He wasn't able to play Cincinnati last year. Was able to now rest and regroup. And you've already seen Alcaraz, the pressure pendulum switches. You know, you saw Alcaraz looked relatively shaky last week. I don't think he looked that impressive last night against Jordan Thompson. How Djokovic has been able to rest and kind of harvest all that strength and energy and so forth. I think you're going to see an incredibly focused, engaged, and impressive Djokovic during these hard court stretch here. I mean, let's not forget. I mean, the guy is without a doubt the most accomplished, best hard court player in the history of tennis. As great as his record is at Wimbledon, hard courts is where he broke through with the Australian Open. I mean, it's where his skills are most obvious. I mean, his movement, his balance, his change of direction, his ability to stand in, take the ball early, play offensively, defensively, neutralize. I still put him down as a big favorite at the US Open.
So Justin, going off how Djokovic is, like you would say, kind of a hard court specialist, can you kind of compare Medvedev's playing style also on hard court there too?
Yeah, man, I think it's tough to, I mean, Djokovic is an everything specialist, right, at this point, you know, but Medvedev, I think his results on hard are so far superior to his results on other surfaces, you know, whereas Djokovic is just great on all of them. I mean, Medvedev's great on all of them too. It's all relative, but one of the reasons for Medvedev is that Medvedev's the way he plays stylistically, you know, Medvedev plays so flat and with a lot less spin. So he gets a little bit more speed off of the court on the hard courts, whereas on clay where he has to create more spin and more heaviness of shot is rewarded. That's not his strength. Whereas I think Medvedev's an amazing grass court player too, but I think, you know, Djokovic's game and skills and timing and technique, and then also, once again, the movement. I mean, like, you know, on hard courts, the way these guys move, it's so hard when you play Djokovic. I mean, it's so hard to get the ball through him because he absorbs pace so well, but it's also almost impossible to get the ball away from him because he's so fast and he's got such great balance in the corners and he's got such great shot making. It's kind of pick your poison type stuff. And Medvedev's like that, but he does it a little bit differently. I mean, he's a great mover. He's very long, but he plays deep in the court. But then on serve, he gets through his service games very quickly when he's serving well and gets a lot of free points on his serve. So Medvedev's strategy is hold serve quickly, go for big first serves, big second serves, shorter points on my service games. Don't give them a lot of rhythm there, but then on the return points, play really deep, make them play a lot of balls and use his defense to frustrate them. So he kind of does it in a hybrid way on hard courts, whereas Djokovic is just stays on that baseline, absorbs, redirects, changes direction, you know, just wears you down.
Yeah. Like you were saying about Djokovic taking that hiatus too. I mean, it goes into what we were actually talking about last week, how the summer hard court is some of the best tennis of the year. And it's because you get a lot of unique winners, because I think the fatigue is a massive aspect at this point of the year. So him taking a hiatus here may massively help him going into the US Open. Like 7 out of the last 8 years, there was a unique champion in each of the two Masters 1000 events, Canada and Cincinnati, and now another one with Sinner. So going into the US Open, like, you have to be aware definitely of the fatigue aspect since it's so late in the year. And I don't know whether Alcaraz is going to be fatigued going into that. But yeah, going back to Wimbledon a little bit, we did see that massive run from Eubanks, which was really impressive. But also since then, we've seen more 27 or 28 year old guys finding success. Even Dan Evans, who's 33, won in Washington. So what are your thoughts on guys like him or Kachin winning Swiss Open? Do you think it's an exception, or if they're kind of displaying a trend towards guys that are older, later 20s, early 30s, finding more success as training techniques and nutrition kind of are advancing?
Yeah, I think the Eubanks story is incredible. I mean, and he communicates it so well, and he's so open about his process and his journey, which has been really enjoyable to hear about and learn about. I mean, he's, you know, a very fluid player. In some ways, it's surprising that it's taken him so long to have, I mean, this level of success has been significant, but even, you know, even more moderate success earlier. But as he says, it's really, you know, on a different timeline. But it shows you how small the margins are, right? Like, I think it's too simple to say it's just because of confidence, because I'm a big believer you have to play well to do well to get confidence. You have to have confidence to do well, to play well, to get results. So it's like, you know, it's kind of like they're intertwined, they're interlineated. But you see the way his game has developed. He didn't have a simple game. He's not just a guy who runs and, you know, makes a lot of balls and extracts errors, right? Like, he's got a very proactive game. I mean, but he's got a smooth serve. He hits his forehand big, kicks big cuts. He plays very aggressively. I think that's been the most impressive part for me, is that when he's been in these big moments, it seems like he's comfortable and relaxed enough to play the right way to give him a chance to be successful and to really go after the shots. That's what's been most impressive for me to watch. I mean, he's got a very dangerous game. Obviously, it'll trend more on bigger, you know, faster surfaces or faster conditions. But to see him play against top level players on big courts and big matches at Wimbledon and just play without hesitation was just awesome to watch. In terms of players having success later, I think this has been a trend for a while. I mean, just players have a better understanding of their body, their games, taking care of themselves better, more professional, better resources, better science and technology out there. I think you're going to be seeing that. I mean, you're seeing that in all sports, right? I mean, look at LeBron James. I mean, look at
Brady.
Tom Brady did. Yeah. I mean, so I think you're seeing, I think that trend is crossing over into all things, all sports. You know, the Dan Evans thing is really interesting. I mean, that's a guy who'd been struggling. I mean, I watched, he struggled in Atlanta. He was up big, blew a match. You could tell he didn't have any confidence. In DC, the first set, go back and look at the first set he played in that tournament. I just happened to watch it because I have the tennis on in my office here a lot, and I just have it on in the background, and I'm kind of flicking through matches. And it started on a back court with him losing the first set 6-2. Looked out of sorts, no confidence. And then 6 days later, he breaks through and wins the tournament. So, I mean, if you stick with it and have the right game and have the mental fortitude to push through those tough moments, sometimes it's closer than it seems. And that's a classic example. And I mean, you got to love Dan Evans' moxie. I mean, the way he plays and his variety and how he believes in himself and his whole career arc and trajectory is very unique. So he's someone you enjoy watching play. I mean, the way he's able to manipulate the ball and his craftiness, and I like watching him play.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Justin, quick question. So the older players get, does the marginal utility of coaching decrease too? Because, you know, like you said, they're just kind of growing into themselves. They're more mature. They kind of understand the game better. Does a coach have less of an impact, or would you say more with these guys getting older and then having more success the older they get?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think you could see it both ways. Like, I don't want to hedge your question, but like, I think you could see it both ways. Probably as you get older, you might be more receptive, be able to absorb the information and maybe put into effect better. But maybe when you're younger, you're more open because you have less experience. I mean, I could see it both ways. I think as you get older, you could become less coachable. As you get older, you could become more coachable because you could realize, you know, how helpful it is and that you have to really be more open to learning and getting help. And also that you want more help because you know that there's more value. There's so much value in it. So I could see it both ways. I think a lot of it has to do with just generally how coachable you are. And I think the unique part in tennis is that you hire the coach. It's not like other sports where a third party hires the coach and you guys are just kind of put together and have to make it work, right? Like in tennis, you're the boss of your coach, which is a unique dynamic, but that's a whole nother podcast for another time.
Got it. Thanks. And then just to follow up, when you're coaching certain players and they already have a playing style, like for example, you and Isner, like he's big on serving volleys. I think he kind of plays similar to Eubanks, would you say?
Sorry, I don't need to interrupt you, but he wasn't, if you go look back early on in his career, he didn't serve in volley almost at all.
Yeah. So was that something that you took and said, okay, I see his skill set and where his strong suits are, so let's try this? Or was he already doing that and then you kind of perfected what he was already doing?
I think like any coach, you kind of want to do an inventory of where is the player's game at, both, you know, physically, technically, strategically, emotionally. So like when I first started working with John, that's what I kind of did, is like, look, this is where I see your game. This is where I see your strengths and your weaknesses. This is where I see what players are doing to you. This is where I see what you're trying to do to them. This is what I see that needs to improve. And, you know, here's my vision on how to do it. And then now here's the work that it's going to take. So when I first started working with John, I mean, he was already an incredibly established player and had a lot of success. You know, I just saw a few things that I thought he could improve on. So we went about it no different than you would look at a balance sheet for a company, right? Like, I think, you know, here are your return stats, here are your serving stats, here are, you know, here are some matches to look at where I think you could have done these things differently. And, you know, technically, I think you need to work on these things in order to do that. You know, physically, I think you need to work on these things. Tactically, I think you need to mix in more serve and volley because guys are just blocking back your serve, you know, but in order to serve and volley consistently and with confidence, we need to work on your volleying technique. We need to work on your movement at the net and your anticipation and your understanding of where to cover on your return to serve, standing closer or, you know, use your back and down the line more. But in order to do that, you've got to work on your technique so you feel comfortable doing that. You know, there's a reason why everyone does something. Like, people don't just do things haphazardly, right? Like, you're probably playing a little further back because you're trying to give yourself more time because you feel rushed if you take it earlier. Everything connects, everything correlates. So you got to do it in pieces and build it like you would a house, like through a foundation and in stages. But John, in some ways, he's very easy to coach. In some ways, he's very hard to coach. Some ways, it's easy because he's got, I believe, the best serve of all time. I don't even think it's close. I think, you know, if you just isolate just the serve, I mean, but even that, I believe that he had small ranges that could improve if he did a couple things differently, you know, even a little bit differently. You know, with John, it was easy to kind of pinpoint focusing on a few things because you knew that half of the match, you know, he was already in such good shape. So I've always enjoyed working with John. I mean, got to do it significantly for a short period, and I've been involved for in some way with him and a lot of his other coaches who have done a great job along the way. It's been a fun kind of supplemental thing, and it was fun to be able to travel with him a little bit this summer and be able to bring my son to Atlanta and be in Newport with him, which is a tournament that I used to play all the time. It's fun. And I'm going to be back with him at the US Open and his coach, David McPherson, so we'll get the band back together there, which will be fun. But he's had an amazing career. I mean, he's 38 years old. He's got four kids, and was a top American player for, I don't know, maybe 8 years in a row or something. And top 10 player, semifinalist at the Wimbledon, quarterfinalist at the US Open a couple times, won the Miami Masters 1000, won a zillion tournaments. I mean, he's got a lot to be proud of.
Yeah, definitely.
Speaking of the Hall of Fame Open in Newport, Isner had a very good run there. I mean, beating Tommy Paul, that was an impressive win. And then he came up and he plays Mickelson. Do you have any thoughts about him as a young guy coming up?
I think he's just phenomenal. I was so impressed. I mean, he reminds me a lot of Andy Murray. He's a little bigger than Murray was at his age. His tennis IQ and his variety and drop shots and lobs and changes direction with his backhand and self-belief and just his movement, and he's always there, and he just has just incredible tennis IQ. And I think he's going to have a great career. I wouldn't be surprised if he made a huge run at Wimbledon someday. I think he's got an amazing game for grass. Awesome return to serve, great feel, moves his serve around, great drop shot, changes direction with his backhand, goes after his forehand, absorbs pace. I mean, I think he can play well on all surfaces and will, but I suspect he'll make a huge run at Wimbledon, you know, during his career.
Do you think he's going to be finding success immediately? Because obviously he won a challenger and made the final of this tournament. So,
yeah, I mean, the guy's already ranked like 120 in the world or 130 in the world. He's really impressive. And also he's just unfazed. I mean, he was in Newport alone without a coach, and he's just like playing John in semifinals. There's history there with, you know, the connection with him going to go to Georgia. John's obviously a Georgia legend, and like in a respectful way, he just like went right after John, like no hesitation, no like, you know, intimidation. Like he just like went right after him. Like if it's there to be won, he'll take it. And that comes from an inner belief, like in your game and how good you are and what you're willing to go out there and take, that you know, everyone wants to be great. Everyone wants to be successful, but like it takes a special type of person to go out there and just actually go take it. And there are certain people you see less like, wow, like there's just no hesitation there. And that's what I saw in him. And it was really impressive.
Speaking of US players, I was looking at it recently, the rankings, and there's currently 10 US guys that are in the top 75 players in the world. And I was wondering about that, because do you think that with 10 guys in the top 75, do you think that means that there's a trend towards US players maybe making like a breakthrough and winning a Grand Slam, winning these top tournaments like Fritz winning at Indian Wells? Or do you think really you only start seeing those levels of results happening once people are in maybe the top 10 or the top 5 players in the world?
Yeah, I mean, look, winning a major obviously is like rarefied air, especially these days. I still think there's a big difference between strength and numbers with the Americans and in winning majors, especially with these guys at the top and beating them best out of 5 sets and winning a bunch of the matches in a row. But, you know, you're seeing now you have three American men in the top 12, right, or something.
Yeah.
I still think that's a big difference than breaking through and winning one. The problem is, and I think we've discussed this before in tennis, it's not like if you're close, that means like the law of averages is you're going to win 2 out of 10, 3 out of 10, right? Like in other sports, like it's not like that in tennis because, you know, in an individual sport, you win. If you play similarly, like Tiafoe, Fritz, Tommy Paul, they're great movers, excellent backhands, good forehands, move well, good first serves. That's what Djokovic, Alcaraz, like Sinner, you know, they kind of play the same way, right? They're just doing it a little bit better, you know, to break through and win a bunch of those matches in a row in a major. Hopefully it happens, but I think we should not be complacent that American tennis is fine, but it's in a really good place. And I think that to have strength in numbers is an excellent accomplishment, but I still think, you know, winning those singles majors there's a big difference.
Do you think there's a cultural difference between, say, American players who may be a little more laid back versus players from other countries where you see Alcaraz, you can see how passionate his team and how important he is to them versus, I don't know, let's say like Taylor Fritz with his girlfriend in the box. You know what I mean?
I think that's perceptive, but I don't think you're right. I mean, I think someone like Alcaraz, you could see that like level of intensity and commitment is obvious. But I think like someone like Taylor Fritz, I think is incredibly, from what I understand, I don't know him that well, but he seems to be very focused.
Maybe like someone like Tiafoe, who kind of likes to joke around on the court, or not joke around, but play a little more lighthearted.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Francis enjoys, you know, some of the other components of being a star player and a lot of some of the celebrity stuff and the social media stuff and the NBA stuff. But that kind of seems to be like maybe where the world is now. You know, that's the way these aren't just players, they're social media stars. You know, it's just kind of where the world is. Some people might play better if they're not so just consumed by tennis all the time. Some people might need some distractions to be able to relax more and play their best tennis. I don't think there's one formula. I don't know that there's just one way to do it.
Yeah. Did you find when you were on tour that different players had obviously different personalities, but were there some guys that you just knew not to talk to because, you know, they were laser focused? They didn't want anything to do with trying to make friends on the tour.
Yeah, I think.
Did that correlate with how good they were?
I mean, you have to understand, it's kind of like a traveling circus, right? You're traveling along with the same people every week. I mean, obviously you have your own cliques and your own group of friends, but I mean, there's generally a camaraderie of just, we're in this crazy world together. I mean, obviously, if you like, you don't like, you get along better with, you socialize with, you go to dinner with, you don't. But like, for the most part, most of the guys get along and are respectful and social. And for the most part, people are cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's cool to see you know, I'm sure you've watched Breakpoint. You get like really see the players' personalities there.
Yeah. One more thing about Newport. We saw Kevin Anderson come back, and I wanted to ask because obviously you've seen a lot of Kevin Anderson. He had that epic match with Isner in Wimbledon 2018. Do you think that he's going to see success in his return? Obviously, he retired, I think it was last year, and now he's making a comeback at 38 or something. So do you think he's going to find any success?
Well, first of all, it was awesome to see him come back and then come back and play so well so quickly. I mean, he's a very professional, talk about like intense and like detailed oriented and process oriented. He's a very regimented guy. So I'm sure that if he was going to come back, he had done the work, he was prepared. So yeah, I mean, and also his game looked good. I mean, I think it's for someone like that, it's more about how do they hold up physically, right? Like he didn't retire because he wasn't good enough anymore. He retired because his body kind of stopped being able to rely on his body. So body holds up, you know, obviously becomes harder and harder as you get older. Then I think he can have some results. Now, was that going to be week in and week out? He's got a big game. So I think there's still success out there for him if his body holds up. He's such a professional. I mean, his career. I mean, I played him in a challenger in Champaign-Urbana when he was in college. And, you know, you could see he was talented and a big guy and hit the ball well. But like to know that looking back at his career, he would get to the finals of Wimbledon, finals of the U.S. Open. That's a heck of a career.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the comeback, kind of like Del Potro, where it's not the skill level. It's more just the body, the breakdown and injuries and stuff like that. Because I know Del Potro was actually kind of teasing it, possibly trying to make a comeback this year. And I don't think he ended up going for it at this point. But it's a situation, yeah, where it's not necessarily the skill. It's just that the body is
as a cooperate.
Yeah, exactly. But one aspect of coming back is the fact that you kind of have to, unless you get wild cards, you have to kind of grind through the ranks to get up and get into these tournaments. And one interesting thing that I think we talked about last week was how the ranking system kind of works. And I kind of wanted to hear your perspective on it, because the ranking system is very favorable to if you have like a really good success in one tournament, it can carry you significantly, because making it a deep run can have a major impact. And for someone like the big example that I had was Ben Shelton. Obviously he had that massive run at the Australian Open and hasn't really found the success since then. And I was wondering if you think that is how it should be, in terms of, oh, if you find success in this tournament because it's a major event, it should carry you and keep you really highly rated. Or maybe if you have to continue to find success. One of the ideas I was thinking about, I don't know if this has been discussed in the past by the ATP Tour, but maybe a system where it's not necessarily just a positive, where if you start losing matches, you lose points. I don't know if that would work, but it seems interesting that you can find like really good success in one tournament and then almost coast off of that for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I think that the ranking system rewards big results. I think part of the ranking system is also you want to incentivize players to play a lot, but there's no doubt that, you know, there's sometimes, like you said, big results can carry players for a while, but I don't know that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, the thing is, it's so competitive, and we talk about the margins are so small, like Dan Evans. Like, if Dan Evans is down a set, he's lost a zillion matches in a row, hadn't won matches for a month, loses the first in Washington, 6 days later he wins the tournament, right? Like, you know, there is a small line if you could kind of get going. So I think that the ranking system works. I mean, you don't see even someone like Ben Shelton, obviously he had the big results. I mean, he had a few big results. He's a big result type of guy though. But I think I understand. I mean, players putting it together in the biggest tournaments, I think should be rewarded. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, it makes sense in a lot of ways, because if you're going to be ranked as one of the best players, you have to be able to perform in those big moments. You have to be able to find the success. You can't necessarily just be ranked highly just because you're doing okay at a bunch of tournaments. So I do understand the positive aspect of it. I was just wondering about the sort of idea of just kind of coasting off of one or two big results.
Yeah. And then there's also, like, Kyrgios brings it up a lot too, how, you know, he sits out half the season and his ranking suffers from it. Whereas guys, he says, quote, he's never even heard of or ranked higher than him just because they'll play on the clay and only clay.
I mean, I don't think anyone's coasting. The great part about tennis is that everything is earned. Every week you have to earn it. Every week you have to win the points and win the matches. Different surfaces, different styles, different conditions, and you got to bring it. And I think tennis rewards players that you have consistency, you're rewarded. If you have big results, you're rewarded. You know, you just, the one place you're not rewarded is if you lose or you don't play. Yeah. So, you know, everyone has their own process, their own thoughts on it. But overall, I think the system works pretty well.
Yeah. Moving on from those tournaments and that happened immediately after, now we're kind of getting up to where we are now with the Canadian Open and then Cincinnati. Speaking of a guy that's late on in his career and is seeing some success recently is Monfils. I mean, he comes into Canada. I didn't really have that high of expectations for him getting success, and then makes a run there. And then here in Cincinnati, he just beat Nori, and I think he just won his match today as well. Do you think this is just kind of like a last, like squeezing the last little bit out of his career? Because I know he teased it maybe retiring. He talked about he wanted to spend more time with his kid. Do you think it's kind of a last gasp of his career? Or do you think he's, if he starts to find more success like this, he's going to be like, oh, well, if I can win these big matches, I'm not going to retire.
Like a second win.
Exactly.
I mean, look, he's great for the game, and he's entertaining, and he's obviously incredibly athletic. And so I think it's great for the game. I think for someone like that, it's really about how long will his body hold out, right? I mean, even I was watching in Cincinnati where it seemed like he, against Nori, like he was going to have to stop playing, which we've seen so many times, and then he cuts through it. So I think on a different level than like a Kevin Anderson or Del Potro, like you know, he still shows that he has the skills. It's just a matter of, you know, will his body hold out for, you know, that's the thing about tennis. It's like, you know, is it back to back to back, all that cumulative physical work and wear and tear on your body? Like, everyone loves watching him. He's entertaining. He's an amazing talent. So I think it's, hopefully he can stay healthy.
Yeah. But also, I mean, in Canada, he wasn't the only guy that was unexpected that we saw winning big matches. I mean, we saw Giron win that match. We saw Deminar making a massive run, Davidova Shakina. Do you think we're going to see more of that? I mean, we kind of already have a little bit in Cincinnati. Do you think we're going to maybe see an unexpected guy in the final or maybe winning the tournament?
You know, like you said, I mean, Canada generally, there seems to be more opportunities with people popping through in Canada, whether it's because a few of the top players don't inevitably go there, which then kind of shifts the draw. Like, I think it's a big difference when you only have to beat one of the top players, or then one couple of the top players lose, and then, you know, you can maybe beat the guy that beats the guy, right? Like, it's there is that knock-on effect, whereas as you get then down to the Cincinnati and the U.S. Open, you know, now Djokovic is playing, and now Alcaraz has a few more matches under his belt, and now, you know, like, things kind of, there's kind of a regression to the mean, you know, as you get closer to, you know, the bigger events. So, but also you see players break through, and you know a player like Sinner, like, that's a big step in his development, right? Like, winning that Masters 1000, like, that's that next step, right? But you see players pop through all the time, and once again, that's the beauty of the sport. I mean, Mackie McDonald just had a big win again today, beat Rune. That's the great part. You never know who's going to break through. I mean, these players, there's not that big of a difference. I mean, there's a difference, but there's not that big of a difference between, you know, between the players. So, you know, if a player gets hot or a player gets confident or the conditions are favorable, then it's about how do they sustain it, right? Look, Dan Evans didn't win a lot of matches. Then he wins Washington. Now he's lost a couple first rounds again. You get to the next tournament late, right? Different conditions. You're a little beaten up. You're, you know, cause and effect is real every week. The knock-on effect, it creates opportunities for others, right? So it's like there's opportunities out there for, you know, players to shine.
Yeah. You mentioned Alcaraz getting more matches under his belt. Do you think that him having more matches now will help him? Or do you think he may be more fatigued going into the U.S. Open?
I don't think that dude gets fatigued. I meant more matches, like, in the conditions, like in the hard courts and so forth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the guy played a ton on the clay. He hadn't played on hard since Miami, right? So, I mean, that's a long window. Getting more reps in the conditions in terms of then the patterns on hard courts and the court positioning and the speed of the balls and the way the ball plays and then the humidity, you know, in the U.S. summer and that and so forth. I don't think that guy gets tired. Built different. He's a freak physically. And I mean that in a positive way. The adrenaline just piercing through his veins. I mean, it's that guy. He seems like he's like one giant fast twitch muscle. Like, I don't worry about any fatigue with him.
Yeah. Speaking of Cincinnati, though, kind of settling in right before the U.S. Open, one guy that I kind of want to hear your thoughts on is Félix Auger-Aliassime. He won the first round here in Cincinnati, but he lost in the second, and he's lost in, I think, five first rounds in his last five tournaments. And I'm wondering, like, kind of going back a little bit to the ranking system, do you think it's better when, because he's been struggling a little bit with injuries, I think his shoulder and maybe his knee, I don't remember exactly what the second injury was. Do you think it's better for a guy like him to step out and fully recover and make sure that he's all good, or to try and stay in these tournaments and maybe get a win or two? Because to me, it seems like it's kind of a, if you don't allow your body to fully recover, then you're not going to be able to find, like, the real, like, deep runs and success that maybe you expect out of yourself.
It's tough because you want to get healthy, but you also want to get matches, right? So, I mean, I don't know where he's at physically or mentally. I don't know where the challenges are, but, you know, he obviously, you know, had a good win to start this week and with against Berrettini, but he struggled relatively to how incredible of a player he is. But that's one of the parts of it's tough. Unless you're really in the inner circle, it's tough to know what's, you know, it's easy to speculate from the outside, right? Like, but without really being in there, you don't know which is the driver, right? Like, is he struggling because is it physical ailments? Is it confidence? You know, is it better to play more, play less? I understand what you're saying in terms of getting away, like Shapovalov, I saw just pulled out of the US Open, and he's been struggling. It seemed like he was playing a bunch and but wasn't really 100%, and then he was losing. And then is that helpful because you're losing confidence? It's just tough to speculate when you don't, when you're not really on the inside. I will say that in today's day and age, if you're not 100%, I don't care how good you are, you're really not going to have much success. I shouldn't say if you're not 100%, because probably everyone has some sort of injury or some sort of impediment every week, right? But like, and that's the thing, there's also the difference between being injured or a little nicked up. You know, you can't play through an injury, but if you're a little, you know, everyone's dealing with something every week, a sore shoulder, a sore back, you know, a foot or an ankle, that's, you know, but that's the difference between playing with, you know, if something's pulled or torn or, you know, something like that, you can't play through that stuff. So, you know, it's, you know, players are laying it on the line every week, but if you're not close to 100%, I mean, it's just too competitive out there. You're not going to have success anyway.
Yeah, definitely a good point. Tough to know, to speculate on it without having a real view into what he's feeling, what he's going through. That's mainly it for what I wanted to ask. Eric, do you have any specific questions you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, I do actually. So Justin, I was wondering if you can talk about different workouts that tennis players do in the gym or out on the court that would help improve their game and functionality. Because, you know, I had the realization when I was playing the other day that I'm moving super slow, and I kind of realized that the lifts I'm doing are not very practical to playing tennis. You know, I love hitting the gym, getting bench, squat, but, you know, I feel like I wasn't really moving that fast on the court, and it wasn't helping my, I guess, tennis muscles. So just wondering if you can talk about that a little bit.
I think there's a lot of tennis specific training. There's a difference between working out for the beach and working out for the court, right?
Right. Exactly.
You want to work tennis specific stuff, where there's different plyometric drills or different types of, you know, now you see a lot of the players, you know, there's very, you know, you're doing a lot of the band work, a lot of tennis, you know, similar tennis movements that are based on explosiveness and, you know, a lot of core stuff, but I'm not really an expert in that area.
Yeah, I decided I'm going to dedicate one day a week to do, you know, the box jumps and the core medicine ball stuff. Just, yeah, exactly. Some fast twitch stuff. And then my other question was, because I saw that movie, the Air Jordan movie with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, and it kind of got me wondering if, for example, I know you worked with Nike. Do brands build around the players in tennis? Like as far as, you know, designing the clothes or the style, the shoes, do they pick it on the person, or do they have what they design in mind and then the player kind of adapts to that? So like a player that comes to mind for me is Tommy Paul. Like I love his kind of aesthetic out on the court, you know, backwards hat, baggy clothes. It kind of reminds me of the 90s, like kind of a more retro look. So I was wondering if New Balance kind of picked him to put their style into place, or identified him as someone that would look good in New Balance, just how that works.
I have to tell you, I saw him in Newport. I'm a big Tommy Paul fan. Watching him practice, I mean, what an athlete. I was so around the sport that closely in a few years. And to be back on the tour and to see the physicality and the movement and the ball striking and the athleticism. And he's one of the guys that stood out to me. I was like, I was blown away. And then he is a very, very handsome man. I have to tell, I mean, impressive in every way. I mean, his, to watch him on the court, I have a lot of regard for how he plays, his skill, his physicality, his athleticism, his coordination. I see the same thing. Like I like watching him play. I mean, he's just, he's fun. He's dynamic. He's explosive. You know, he's got variety. He can play from everywhere on the court. I think he's a good fit for a brand, presents himself well. He competes hard, in great shape. It's business, right? I mean, you're trying to market your product and get exposure. And, but yeah, all the brands are, I think a big part of who they support comes down to, you know, how they can move product. That's what the game is. It's not a charity. It's a business.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I could tell you it works because I've been buying a lot of New Balance tennis clothes.
That just proves it works.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I feel cool out there on the court.
Feel good, play well, right?
Yeah, exactly. All right, should we hop into segments?
Sounds good to me. What's new in tennis? What'd you see, Eric?
Yeah, so this isn't the best news. I saw Riley Opelka just pulled out of the U.S. Open, which is very unfortunate because that means he would have missed all four slams this year. And his injury seems pretty bad, too. So he started off with a hip injury, had to get surgery, and then now it's his wrist. And just unfortunate to see, you know, an American player having to miss the U.S. Open. But on the bright side, he did post some workout videos. He's out there moving around. So I think this is just cautionary, and he'll be back. I don't think we've seen the last of Riley Opelka.
Yes, as you said, it's unfortunate. I mean, he's making great strides in his career. I've been seeing those. I'm close with Riley. I adore him, and I'm such a big believer in his talent. I think that, you know, hopefully he gets healthy. He's a special type of talent. He's kind of like an Isner-type talent, right, that he could just he could do things that a lot of players can't do and impact you in ways that a lot of players can't. So, you know, hopefully he gets back there soon. I've seen some of those videos as well. He looks fit as a fiddle, getting his body ready. Hopefully it cooperates.
Yeah, Aiden, what did you see out there?
Mine is actually from a match from today. Tsitsipas was playing Shelton. It was a close match, but one of the moments that kind of was funny and stood out was Tsitsipas was serving, and initially he thought there was a bee near him, and he kind of just tried to like swat at it around him. And then he realized that there was a person in the crowd buzzing when he was going to serve. And when he realized, he like went up to the umpire and tried to get the person kicked out. To me, it's just an interesting thing in terms of when you compare it to kind of other sports, how tennis is, it's completely silent when you're out there, and something so small could be so impactful, like making this sound like a bee. Whereas you look at kind of an NBA game or something, and these fans are yelling obscene things, and it's just such a different atmosphere.
The counter to that is like golf, right? Like, look, and I think part of it has to do with the execution dynamic of tennis. You're initiating impact from a still position, as opposed to in a lot of other sports, it's just total chaos, and there's a lot more reaction involved. So I see it both ways. Like, I do think tennis players, golfers, and others, you know, people just take it too far in terms of, but I do think that there's a precision aspect in tennis and golf that are unique.
Yeah, I think it's a respect thing too. Like in all the tournaments, they don't let the crowd come and go as they please. It has to be on a break. And that's just what the players are used to. So if you were to, you know, change them up and distract them, then I don't think it's fair. Basketball, it's always been like that. So it's just something that's part of the game that, you know, you're already used to.
100%. I just kind of thought it was an interesting way for someone to try to distract, to buzz like a bee. Like, how did this person come up with, oh, I'm just going to start buzzing like a bee while he's serving? But kind of a strange move. But all righty, you want to hop into Bet of the Week?
The guy was probably betting on Shelton. That's why I was doing it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I am super pumped for my bet of the week. I'm taking Medvedev -210 over Zverev. And I was tempted to do what I did last week and take the over on sets, I believe, or over 2.5 sets was +110. But to be honest, I think that Medvedev just kind of has his name here. You know, it's a huge match. I think there's going to be a lot of tension, which I feel Medvedev handles better than Zverev, because they have kind of that beef back in Monte Carlo where Medvedev asked to use the toilet, and then he ended up winning the match. And Zverev said that he played unfairly, but I don't know. I think Medvedev kind of has this one in the bag. He's won the last three matches against them, the last one being on clay, which is you know, apparently not his specialty, whereas Zverev's better on clay. This one's on hard, so I'm taking Medvedev, and I'm super excited to watch this.
Awesome. I think that will be definitely an exciting matchup. So I'm actually taking the big underdog, Tommy Paul, over Alcaraz. But obviously, Tommy Paul can beat him.
He beat him twice, right? He beat him
both
back-to-back years in Canada, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Exactly. So he won it last week. He's obviously has the skill to do it. And also Alcaraz did have a longer first round matchup. So I think that you look at this matchup and I think it could go either way. And so I think +265 is a pretty good odds considering Tommy Paul is such a good player.
Yeah, I like that.
Have you guys seen the head-to-head history between Djokovic and Monfils? I don't know whether it's 19 or 18 or 20 something. It's crazy. They play.
Here goes Monfils. He's going to take his first win over Djokovic.
Hey, if this is the year, I think this is the one to happen.
I don't see it.
No. All right, well, speaking of Rusevori, my match of the week was him upsetting Rublev 7-6, 5-7, 7-6. This was a phenomenal match. The first set tiebreaker went to 12-10. And it's obviously a huge win for Rusevori because, you know, he's 0-2 against Rublev. Rublev is in the top 10. And you saw a lot of the emotion and passion from Rublev, too. Like him throwing the racket, he even hit himself a couple times in the head. And he was able to turn around the second set, force Rusevori to double fault that second set. And credits to Rusevori for coming back and winning the third set after double faulting the second set. I feel like that would just take such a mental toll on anyone. And for him to do that and close that out, very rewarding for the match of the week for me.
Definitely a good match. I actually went with the match of Alcaraz beating Thompson. Long match, three sets, 7-5, 4-6, 6-3. What I saw from this match was I saw a good amount of like long strategic points. And what I thought was really actually cool though was there were a lot of points where it seemed like they hit shots with just no margin for error. And I think for Thompson, he realized like that's kind of what you need to beat Alcaraz. But one of the things it revealed to me is Alcaraz, I think one of the things that makes him stand out as a player, I mean, obviously you see it from like Djokovic too. I think it's really what makes that the top guys stand out up like above the rest is they can make a full stretch defensive shot and have it all of a sudden be an aggressive shot. Like you'll see Alcaraz go full extension on a backhand and then put it like perfectly up the line and you're like, how did he just do that? It was also a thing that I think was on display at Wimbledon as well. And so I just think that's really kind of what makes him and other top players stand out is that they can take a shot that should be heavily defensive and somehow make it aggressive.
Yeah, when you said that, I just immediately thought of the Djokovic backhand sliding split where he just, that's kind of his signature shot, you know?
I'm going to go with Mackie McDonald. I'm just going to give some love to UCLA Bruins. There's been some really good results from both McDonald, Giron, and Rogier won the doubles last week. So three Bruins that are having a lot of success, which I'm really proud of. Mackie McDonald had an excellent shot of getting to another quarterfinal, got to the quarterfinals last week, beating Raonic, plays Mannarino tomorrow, who's obviously a tough veteran, but Mackie hits the ball clean as a whistle, and it's always good to see those Bruins have success. So I'm just going to give a little pop to the Bruins and having some good results, and hopefully keep it going tomorrow.
Yeah, Cressy was a Bruin too, right?
Cressy was, yeah. He's been struggling as of late and back, but considering the Bruins college program hasn't been doing as great, but they, in terms of success with pros on the tour right now, it's been good.
Yeah, always got to show love to the alma mater. Do you ever go back and visit?
Well, go back and visit, it's only about 15 minutes that way. So I hit balls there all the time. And yeah, I'm always around. I always bring my son to baseball games, Jackie Robinson Stadium. So yeah, I'm around UCLA a lot.
Good. Yeah, I wish I would go back up to Ithaca a little more often, but it's not exactly 15 minutes that way.
Yeah. Well, that was great. Thank you for coming back on, Justin. Always great to have you on, and look forward to maybe having you back on in the future as well.
And after the U.S. Open, there'll be plenty to talk about then.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, maybe we'll see you too. We both plan on going.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to be there in the beginning.
Awesome. Well, hey, appreciate the time. Always enjoy the conversation, and hopefully see you soon. All right, and that's the show. If you're not already subscribed, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube at Painting Lines Podcast. feel free to shoot us a DM or email us any questions or thoughts at paintinglinespodcast@gmail.com.